So I'm very pleased to be able to speak with Mr. Sol Itai, an original co-founder of Lending Club, and now the founder of Genron in China, progressing the peer-to-peer platform universe, and probably one of the few people who are familiar with how it's been developing in the U.S. and then now in China. Tell us what it comes to the top of your mind in terms of what you think is the biggest difference between peer-to-peer in China as opposed to how it's evolving in the U.S.
Right. So in the U.S., the idea of a fintech company, peer-to-peer in particular, is to create a good product both on the borrower side as well as on the lender side that did not exist before. So we improved the level of finance industry that was happening in the country. But in China, that same idea is about building an infrastructure that did not exist before. So when in the US we are able to reduce the interest rates for a borrower by 4 or 5 points, in China we are able to give loans to people that were not able to get a loan before. And that is because of structural imbalances of the banking system in China, where you are left with two choices. You are either someone who has assets, can apply for a loan at a bank, and if you're not accepted, you have no choice but to go to the shadow banking where they charge you with
So it's more of a financial inclusion agenda in China, bringing on board an entire part of the population that's not seen credit before?
No, not exactly. The financial inclusion is definitely there, but it's more about building infrastructure to make retail lending, especially to consumers and SMEs, a reality. China has been known not to have a very strong retail lending business in the country.
To start with,
exactly. Okay. So these solutions that we built in the retail market are applicable both for core industry as well as for financial inclusion as well.
So you're trying to bring this conversation with banks into the picture in China, where actually that conversation is further down the road in the U.S. And in fact, sometimes marketplace lending can be said to be an originator for banks. That's how the banks seem to be relating with the P2P players. Whereas in China, that whole origination process is still in its infancy. It's huge. It's self-sustainable. They don't need to have that conversation with the banks.
Right. Back to the same point again. U.S. banks have a history of 30, 40, 50 years of retail banking. They know how to get assets by themselves. When we came in, we focused mainly on what I call the logistics of finance. We reduced the cost of acquisition, the cost of operation, and the cost of getting access to a diversified portfolio. In China, again, we created a market that did not exist before, and that is key. So really, if I have to find another analogy, I would compare it to what Alibaba does in e-commerce, where they have to create payment, logistics, and everything all together, with Amazon, where they just focus on the choice of the product and how to make the experience seamless, but they relied on FedEx and other institutions to do the rest. So that is the main difference between the two.
Being a founder of the industry, being a founding member of the industry as a whole, 2007, 2008, what was it like then? What is it like now in the U.S.? And why wasn't it possible for a lending club to go into China as a lending club?
It's been 10 years. It's been exactly 10 years since we started the lending club. 5 years in the U.S., 5 years in China. I saw a shift in the way the business model is done in the U.S. Originally, when we started, it was a marketplace where borrowers are individuals and lenders are individuals as well. But the pressures on these companies to have more volume and competing over capital has made them choose to work with institutions. So not necessarily banks, but they work also with whatever capital is, hedge fund, large family offices. And you saw at one point, Lending Club, for example, was originating more than $1 billion a month. Half of it did not come from retail. It came from institutions. The interesting part in China is we might think that we have a problem on the borrower side, but the biggest problem in China is that you have so much capital in people's hands, but no investment opportunity.
Yeah.
So there is a report by Oliver Wayman. There is 47 trillion RMB of investable capital, and 22 trillion RMB in loans that should have been given, but they are not financed. It's a perfect ecosystem environment for
and
people.
And so the Chinese are responding to that by recreating themselves as wealth management players to some extent, and even institutional investment platforms rather than you know peer-to-peer. And in the US, I think we've sort of kept that as a pure play as far as possible. What's happening at the back end of that mechanics? Because part of the reason for the institutional fund managers and the hedge funds to come and put in bags of cash in front of these platforms is because of the return, right?
Right.
And given when the markets are have much lower interest rates, and that whole process is a very relationship driven, back of the scene, non technology driven. Dynamics in there.
It's more finance than technology.
And so what's happening in there, and how's that different in China as opposed to...
Right. So first of all, I don't believe that companies in China are moving to wealth management and not focusing on P2P. To start with, you know, we focus 100% on P2P. We have other verticals as well. But we've been doing super well, and it's been attracting 3.7 million lenders. It works. We're not going to change it. We're going to continue growing it. It's a good part of our business. But I think what's happening here is we are teaching investors for the first time how easy it is to use your mobile phone to access investment product. So it's natural that they're going to ask for more and more investment assets that they can relate to. So on our platform, for example, I always have 20% to 30% more capital than assets. So, and yes, we do get phone calls from our customers. We are interested in making investments outside of China. Do you have any investments related to real estate? There is this request coming. The demand on the capital side is really big.
So what would you say would be the big challenge in the industrialization of the credit business on the borrower side, and again, what would the difference be between the U.S. and...
So, we go back to the model that the U.S. created, which is a credit bureau, everybody has a price, everybody has a FICO score, and with that, I can do a lot. It does not exist in China, even though China has the world's largest credit bureau, because we have shadow banking. And if you ask the companies that participate in the shadow banking, which are small loan companies and guarantee companies, to start reporting back to the credit bureau, it's a nightmare. It's not going to work because you have to make sure that their reporting are correct and they don't have enough operations capability to do it. So we're going to live with this shadow banking, which is about 25% of all the financial transactions that happen, for a while. And innovation is really starting there because that's where the need is. Anything and everything we do on the borrower side, whether for inclusion or for everyday business, is to reduce the cost that the borrowers have to pay. We need to reduce it enough to make them capable of paying back their loans. We need to reduce it enough and use data instead of using assets to do business with them. So in that sense, we are discovering a new market. We're creating a new market.
So consumer credit, the threshold for paying in terms of cost of credit, is different from small business.
Correct.
And small business is a higher threshold of pay. What would you, at the top of your mind, think would be a sustainable credit cost in an emerging market, in a developed market?
Really look at the inflation and you can try to come up with a number. But I would like to stress one point, a very important point. It's not a question of capital, but it's a question of product. I'll give you an example of a very successful product in SME. We give loans to restaurants, and the typical loan is that you make a monthly payment. And this qualifies as a small business loan. We came in and we created a new product where the payment is daily because the cash flow of the restaurant is daily. With that product, we reduced the interest rate by 25%. So their all-in cost used to be 40%, 50% from shadow banking. We gave them a 14, 15% cost of capital. And we are able to scale it to a very large amount. So really what is needed is product. And in order to create those products, you have to create infrastructure that allows this product to exist. That is the real important aspect of fintech in China. And that is why it is much larger than any other market.
What seems to be happening in the developed world, and that's not just in the US but Europe as well, is that because of competition and because it's such a narrowly defined industry, the industry seems to be going into more and more high-risk credit, like car loans and resale car loans and so on. Do you think that that's a necessary path? Do you think that it will, that more and more P2P players in the West would be taking on higher risk products?
They don't need to. Take the example of Lending Club and Prosper in the US. 90% of the customers are credit card balance transfers. It's easy for them to take customers away from banks. You have a $20,000 credit card balance. I'll give you a 4 or 5% discount to bring it back to my platform. The efficiency savings between a marketplace lending and the typical bank loan that was provided to the customer, the difference is big enough for them not to have to go to these risky assets. But what you call risky assets, I call a market that have not been yet served. So car loans could be very safe if you have the right product. Car loans could be very safe with the right pricing, with the right credit risk management.
You've watched how you know the Chinese flavor has been evolving, and if you remember Isabel, the big fraud that happened, the world's first large-scale Ponzi scheme on peer-to-peer. And that's the big fear that lots of investors have about peer-to-peer platforms, almost anywhere where it's new. What are the safeguards? How do you separate the good boys from the bad?
Yes, that was a very sad example. Isobal happened in fintech, but it could have happened in any other industries. The criminal mind always thinks of ways to fraud people.
But they're just a governance structure, you know, that. And in China, there was no law until this year, you know, or last year, end of last year.
Right. So if you take the guidelines, the regulatory guidelines that came out 8-9 months ago, there will never be another Ponzi scheme. The solution is very simple. We require all platforms to use a custodian bank account. If you have a custodian bank account, we will know, because you go to the banking system, who you're sending money to. So if you have fake assets, we would know. If you have real assets, we would know. The thing that impresses me the most is that how regulators are actually looking at our problems and they are directing us. So out of those last regulators, there are 5 items that I thought were amazing. So the first one is the custodian. Another one is, okay, you as an industry, you say that you are helping consumers and small businesses. How about I give you a maximum that you cannot go beyond? So that way, both, we understand that we want you to go into that direction. Third one, as a borrower, you cannot borrow from more than 5 platforms. How do you think our industry is going to be able to impose that? It's by having a central place that counts how many times did you borrow. And that is preparing us to become a contributor to the credit bureau. So we are growing, we are maturing, and the regulators are actually helping us becoming good players of the
finance. When you think about industry, the traditional credit bureau model that the banks use, and when you think about the opportunities that the P2P lenders are getting into today, maybe that's exactly where the problem was, because on the one hand, the banks have industrialized credit using the credit bureau. scheme, but it only reaches a certain class of customers. And the reason there's a business case for P2P is because of the failing of the traditional credit bureau. So you seem to be suggesting that a shared infrastructure for credit is the same thing that you need to recreate now for P2P.
I probably have a different answer to what you're expecting me to say. In my opinion, the real value of the credit bureau in the US is not only the pricing. Yes, I know your FICO score, I know your DTI, you have to pay 17.35%. The real value of the credit bureau is the collections. As a customer that you borrowed from me, whether you borrow $20 or $100 or $100 million, it costs me absolutely nothing to report that you are not paying back your loan. It's a very strong collection tool. In China, I cannot use that same thing, because even if I report back to the credit bureau, you have 25% of the market that you can borrow from. So what we need to do is not to take what works in the US and apply it to China, but to find solutions. How do I do collections?
And how have you been finding solutions?
Very good question. So if you are a borrower on our platform, we choose to work with you through the company that you work with. Whether the announcement that we made today, where there is a strong relationship between you as a supplier and the core company, so you have all interest in making sure that you pay back your loan. Otherwise, you are risking the relationship between you and your supplier. Or if you are a truck driver for a logistics company, you need to fill gas, you need to fill your truck with gas all the time. If you don't pay back your loan, you're going to get punished by the logistics company.
So you're working out the supply chain.
One example. But the philosophy is the same.
Right. So in China, the supply chain works. In other words, as long as you belong to a supply chain of distributors or manufacturers and so on, you can work that. And actually, several of the peer-to-peer players take that model for different supply chains. Some of them in Shenzhen, some of them...
Right. I think what we announced today is much, much, much bigger than that example. But let me not confuse you. Let me bring you back to how do we make sure we get collections for almost free. So our way of acquiring borrowers is not to go directly to the borrower and have him borrow directly from us. We work with large companies. A logistics company, for example, has thousands of truck drivers that deliver their parcels, and they always need gas to deliver. So we're happy lending money to these drivers. They are not employees of the logistics company, but if they don't pay their loan on time, they will not get any business back again from the logistics company. And the logistics company wants us to pay them because it increases their business.
Have you tested this proposition in other large markets? India, Indonesia, Brazil, South Africa, countries with more than 100 million people, are they all the same? Is it generally applicable?
I will guess it is, but to be honest with you, China is just so big of a market that can keep us growing and busy for many years.
Is China another side of, another extreme of the spectrum?
We choose China to do our business because of three reasons. The first one, internet is available, and we are an internet company. Second, there is a very good system of laws. So even before we...
An identity. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
So even before we arrived, if you borrow money from me and you don't pay, I can sue you, and we go in front of the judge and he has rule. And the third one, Chinese and the Chinese culture create people that have an entrepreneurship mentality.
So they're using the money for something.
Yes, okay. I have money. I have to make it make more money. In Europe, people are more focused on joie de vivre, and enjoying life, and it's not really the same hungry mentality that we need to create things. So China is perfect in that sense for our business.
Right. Do you think that with interest rates on the uptrend led by the U.S., that it will have an effect on fintech because of the investments that fintech tends to attract when interest rates are low and the cost of funds are low, and the difference between the kind of money that will be made available as cost of funds go up. and the lending business itself, especially with the uptake on interest rates.
So we always get asked that question, and we always try to answer that the beauty of the marketplace lending business model is to never have a balance sheet. So you're not really affected by interest rates going up or interest rates going down. What you do when interest rates fluctuate, you adjust your pricing accordingly. So if people are able to borrow at 3% more than what they were borrowing, you have to adjust your rates. So a marketplace is...
So the rates will always be transparent and the rates...
Absolutely.
Will always move. But the people lending would then have other sources of attractive income, so...
True, but the difference between the asset class that we created is a fixed income product with attributes like no correlation between the assets and very predictable. Yes, you can even make the point before interest rate change. Why not invest in the stock market? Because you want to diversify. You want to have this type of lending, this type of investment, and you want to have fixed income. There are different reasons why. We're not saying that one asset class is better than anyone else. It's better today, it's competitive tomorrow, and it's not.
But in China, a lot of that lending and borrowing doesn't actually take place on the platform. The credit checks that you need to do are done manually. The lenders are coming with portfolios of money to ask you to deploy that. How much of lending takes place on the platform?
At Dierno, 100%. At Dierno, 100%. Our model does not start from the capital. Our model starts from the asset. We are a pure P2P platform. And that's why we are classified number one in compliance, number one in transparency. We start from the borrower. We underwrite him, we get all the information, and we price him. Because you're 32 years old, you've been living in the same place for 12 years, you have two kids, you're stable, you're going to pay less than another person. And we put him on our platform, and we don't make decisions for lenders. They look and they pick. I want to lend money to people that are coming from Shanghai. I want to lend money to women because I think women don't have enough opportunity as much as men do. And they are better borrowers, to be honest with you. So it is a pure P2P platform, and everything for us happens on the marketplace.
But there comes a point where regulators will say, you may be an exchange, and they do this to traditional exchanges already, asking you to put capital into it, asking you to put liquidity into it, almost as if you're holding the risk.
We see exactly the opposite. We see exactly opposite signs from the regulators. Again, part of the other five items that I was saying, I said three. One of them is you cannot guarantee anything, whether it's returns or maturity. We want you to be completely independent platform and do not participate in the transaction. No, I think they are really supporting the marketplace pure P2P model.
You talked about how you're building your supply chain-based network in China. And one very interesting question that I just wanted to explore with you is, do you think that blockchain would add to that at some point? Is it a natural model for strengthening that approach?
What we announced today is probably the biggest fintech project I've ever worked on in my life. It is really a revolution of how supply chain works. Let me tell you what I mean by that. Suppliers are not created equal. There are different levels of suppliers. The car that is made by Ford, there is someone who delivers the dashboard, and that supplier relies on other suppliers and other suppliers and other suppliers. In any country, whether it's China, Mexico, or India, only level one gets funded. And people that are in level one are no more than 15% of the whole chain. With our solution, with what we announced today, is doesn't matter which level you are in, doesn't matter how much you're borrowing, whether it's $300 million or $100,000, with our solution, we guarantee you that you're going to get funded. Because with blockchain and the ability to create a trustable system that carries out the relationship between level one to level two and so on, we maintain the credit worthiness of every supplier participating in that project directly linked to the core company. And what we announced today is Fincom, which is the supply chain finance company of Foxconn, is part of the solution with us together. So that is by itself a revolution in the way.
The troubling thought about blockchain, and a lot of people in finance who speak about blockchain, is they want to make themselves the center of blockchain, whereas the original idea of blockchain was that there was no center, there is no broker.
There's absolutely no center in blockchain. Blockchain is, if I have to find an analogy for blockchain, is the internet itself. There is no center.
Right. And so by taking that approach, you're putting yourself in the center of making that value chain work.
No.
You're opening yourself to competition, because anyone else who's plugged into it can take your customer away from you.
Absolutely. We are not saying that. In our statement today, we said that first we are inclusive, and we don't say that we are the only one in the world that can do this. So other people can do it.
It's very interesting to see how you evolve if you keep to the originality of your thought. Just two more questions.
Sure.
Your conversation with Chinese banks.
Right.
And here, one thing at the back of my mind is this. They make as much money from trust companies as part of the
channel. So you do know how the whole thing
works.
Yeah.
So are you just another trust company?
No. So I'll give you three examples of our relationship with banks. Number one, Standard Chartered Bank and Qingdao Bank are investors in the company. Number two, if you look at Suzhou Bank, which is a city commercial Bank of Suzhou, we created their whole fintech platform. It's the same technology that Yano has, we gave to them. And they are operating it as a marketplace, and it's growing. Number three, with solutions like what we came up with today, and with other solutions, we are helping banks to access good quality assets. So I don't believe that an economy can exist without banks. I don't believe also that what banks do offer today is enough of an infrastructure so we can fund all the billion people that are going to be living in the cities, or the 7 billion people we have around the world. If you double or even triple the bank capacity that we have today, there is no way we can help all those people that want to borrow money for a car or go to school. The only thing that I know of that has the ability to create a large-scale solution is technology. And they know that as well. And that's why they are very interested in what we do.
Final question. Your biggest competitors, Lufax, Credit Ease, and now Alipay, they seem to have the payment component to what they do, and you've not spoken about payments at all.
I don't think Lufax has a payment component. But
Alipay does, and the other one is China Credit has Credit China, something like that. Yeah.
We think payments and credit are completely different.
Lufax and Credit Ease talk about wealth,
right?
And the other two talk about payments.
So I'm not saying we don't have wealth management. I'm saying that B2B has been working perfect for us. Our default rate so far is 2.4% of everything that we issue, which is 26 billion. So it's not a research project, it's real business. So it's working for us, our customers are happy, we're gonna continue growing it. We are developing other things, including wealth management as well. The difference, I think, is that Yarrow, we have a strategy that we started 4 years ago, and we maintain our focus on it, and we keep building on it. We don't change our strategy every 3 months, every 4 months. It's really working for us, and it's solid, and we continue doing it.
So, Hitai, this is going to be a continuing conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Pleasure.